Whether he liked it or not, by accepting the Templeton Prize, Dyson had sent a powerful signal to the world. It would be taken as an endorsement of religion by one of the world's most distinguished physicists.
I am content to be one of the multitude of Christians who do not care much about the doctrine of the Trinity or the historical truth of the Gospels.
But isn't that exactly what any atheistic scientist would say if he wanted to sound Christian? I gave further quotations from Dyson's acceptance speech, satirically interspersing them with imagined questions to a Templeton official.
Oh, you want something a bit more profound as well. How about, I do not make any clear distinction between mind and God. God is what mind becomes when it has passed beyond the scale of our comprehension. Have I said enough yet, and can I get back to doing physics now? Oh, not enough yet. Okay, then. How about this? Even in the gruesome history of the 20th century, I see some evidence of progress in religion. The two individuals who epitomised the evils of our century, Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, were both avowed atheists. Can I go now?
Dyson could easily refute the implication of these quotations from his Templeton acceptance speech, if only he would explain clearly what evidence he finds to believe in God, in something more than just the Einsteinian sense which, as I explained in Chapter 1, we can all trivially subscribe to. If I understand Horgan's point, it is that Templeton's money corrupts science. I'm sure Freeman Dyson is way above being corrupted, but his acceptance speech is still unfortunate if it seems to set an example to others. The Templeton Prize is two orders of magnitude larger than the inducements offered to the journalists at Cambridge, having been explicitly set up to be larger than the Nobel Prize. In Faustian vein, my friend the philosopher Daniel Dennett once joked to me, Richard, if ever you fall on hard times. For better or worse, I attended 2 days at the Cambridge conference, giving a talk of my own and taking part in the discussion of several other talks. I challenged the theologians to answer the point that a God capable of designing a universe, or anything else, would have to be complex and statistically improbable. The strongest response I heard was that I was brutally foisting a scientific epistemology upon an unwilling theology. Theologians had always defined God as simple. Who was I, a scientist, to dictate to theologians that their God had to be complex? Scientific arguments, such as those I was accustomed to deploying in my own field, were inappropriate, since theologians had always maintained that God lay outside science. I did not gain the impression that the theologians who mounted this evasive defence were being willfully dishonest. I think they were sincere. Nevertheless, I was irresistibly reminded of Peter Medawar's comment on Father Teilhard de Chardin's The Phenomenon of Man, in the course of what is possibly the greatest negative book review of all time.
Its author can be excused of dishonesty only on the grounds that before deceiving others, he has taken great pains to deceive himself.
The theologians of my Cambridge encounter were defining themselves into an epistemological safe zone where rational argument could not reach them because they had declared by fiat that it could not. Who was I to say that rational argument was the only admissible kind of argument? There are other ways of knowing besides the scientific, and it is one of these other ways of knowing that must be deployed to know God. The most important of these other ways of knowing turned out to be personal, subjective experience of God. Several discussants at Cambridge claimed that God spoke to them inside their heads, just as vividly and as personally as another human might. I've dealt with illusion and hallucination in Chapter 3, the argument from personal experience, but at the Cambridge conference I added 2 points. First, that if God really did communicate with humans, that fact would emphatically not lie outside science. God comes bursting through from whatever otherworldly domain is his natural abode, crashing through into our world where his messages can be intercepted by human brains. Has that phenomenon really nothing to do with science? Second, a God who is capable of sending intelligible signals to millions of people simultaneously and of receiving messages from all of them simultaneously cannot be, whatever else he might be, simple. Such bandwidth! God may not have a brain made of neurons or a CPU made of silicon, but if he has the powers attributed to him, he must have something far more elaborately and non-randomly constructed than the largest brain or the largest computer we know. Time and again, my theologian friends returned to the point that there had to be a reason why there is something rather than nothing. There must have been a first cause of everything, and we might as well give it the name God. Yes, I said, but it must have been simple, and therefore whatever else we call it, God is not an appropriate name.